Good morning. We are now nearly 2 weeks out from the Thanksgiving holiday, and we continue to see the same slow, steady downward trends in new cases, positivity rates, hospitalizations that we have since mid-November. However, it's critical that these trends continue throughout this month and that we continue to reduce the number even further. We've made good progress over the last few weeks, but our ultimate goal is to get virus activity to a level that we can manage over the next few months. I want to take this time to thank Iowans for stepping up and doing your part, and I hope you've seen how that effort has paid off. We really can stop the spread of the virus if we continue to work together. We are eagerly awaiting the FDA's approval of Pfizer and Moderna vaccines and are optimistic that word will come by the end of this week. In the meantime, we're continuing to ensure our readiness to receive and distribute the vaccine once it's shipped. Last week, the Department of DHS and the Iowa Department of Public Health, Director Kelly Garcia, provided an in-depth overview of the state's updated vaccine distribution strategy, including the approximate allocations of each vaccine that we expect to receive. Iowa is prioritizing healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents and staff in the first round of vaccine shipments. Hospitals that will be receiving a portion of the initial shipment of the Pfizer vaccine have now been notified and are making plans for how the vaccines will be administered to their workforce at their facilities. As you also heard, Iowa will be participating in the Long-Term Care Pharmacy Partnership, and that's a federal program that leverages national pharmacy chains to distribute and administer the vaccine in long-term care facilities statewide. Pending vaccine approval, we expect to begin vaccinations in long-term care facilities as early as December 28th. This week, the Iowa Department of Public Health is holding webinars with leaders from Walgreens and CVS in Iowa for local public health departments and long-term care facilities to learn more about how the program and how it will be implemented. This coordination between our teams will help ease operations as the program launches and ensure its success statewide. As you also know, long-term care facilities are home to some of our most vulnerable Iowans, and doing everything we can to protect them from COVID-19 has been one of our highest priorities since the pandemic began. In addition to including them in the initial round of vaccinations, the state will also be providing a 30-day supply of PPE, including masks, gowns, and gloves, to Iowa's 432 facilities to support enhanced infection prevention protocols at no cost to the facilities. Details are being coordinated now, and distribution is expected to begin next week. The state has also, I'm proud to say, secured contract nurses from across the country to temporarily work in Iowa hospitals that are in need of additional relief and staffing. More than 80 nurses will have started by the end of this week, and we anticipate that in the coming days, a total of 104 nurses will be assigned throughout the state to work with our hospitals through December 30th. This additional staffing is being funded through Iowa CARES allocation, and it'll help ensure that we're prepared to handle any increase in hospitalizations that could occur during the holidays. Additionally, we've also increased our contact tracing resources to ensure that case investigations process continues in a timely manner for those who've recently been diagnosed with COVID-19. This week, we have had an additional 200 contact tracers, case investigators, will be providing support to the state doing case investigations for 65 of Iowa's 99 counties. And funding for these resources is also through the state's CARES allocation. Since the pandemic began, I just want to say that I have been so impressed with the unprecedented collaboration among Iowa's healthcare providers. Organizations that would otherwise be competitors have willingly come together these last 9 months to partner, all for the purpose of ensuring Iowans have the care that they need and deserve, regardless of circumstances. A few weeks ago, we tested that resolve as we saw hospitalizations climb dramatically statewide. But working together as one healthcare system, Iowa's medical providers made sure that everyone who needed care got it. And now we're about to make even that easier. Together with the state, Mercy One is establishing the Iowa COVID-19 Hospital Transfer Line. It's a centralized resource that any hospital can use when they need to move a COVID-19 patient to another facility. So now I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce Bob Ritz, who's the CEO of Mercy One, to share more information about this new initiative. Bob?
Thank you, Governor Reynolds, and it's truly a pleasure to be here. And I really want to take this opportunity to congratulate all of you. The work that you have been doing with all of us to help fight this pandemic has been nothing short of miraculous. So I know everybody wins the game on Monday morning, but we're in the game now, and we are for a long time still. But progress is on the way, and I think much of that's due to your leadership and the partnership that you referred to between our health systems here in Iowa, all healthcare professionals. The public health department has been just incredible, and it's certainly the National Guard, the media, all of us working together to give our communities a sense of hope for the future. The other thing I want to do is I want to thank all the healthcare workers that are taking care of COVID patients and those that are supporting them. You know, they're often referred to as healthcare heroes. We have hundreds of thousands of healthcare heroes all the time. But these individuals are not just stretched at home, they're stretched at work and vice versa. And you can imagine what that means after 9 months. And for 9 months, our teams have been working tirelessly to protect Iowans. And I know looking back, I think we've done an incredible job. We know the precautions are important. We ask every Iowan to remember to wear a mask, keep your distance, particularly during holidays, because it's going to be tempting, and wash your hands frequently. Hope is right around the corner. And one example of that is, in fact, this Iowa Hospital Transfer Line. Over the last 9 months, we have worked together to make sure all Iowans get access to health care. And we've had to essentially use innovation and collaboration and adjust our hospitals and our health systems to care for this very new population of patients. And I think we've done so in a very effective way. It's in that same spirit of that innovation that the Iowa Hospital Transfer Line became a reality just recently. And I should say collaboration. You know, hospitals often transfer patients to another hospital for a different level of care. And we do that all the time. But during the pandemic, with these episodic waves of infections and surges, the bed supply gets tighter. And that the difficulty in transfer of a patient is remarkably different. And what happens is an individual at a hospital will make a phone call to another hospital. And they usually have those hospitals they call. But when the bed supply tightens up in urban and rural Iowa, those calls become many. And the complexity of that process can be really disheartening. So I think with the partnership that the governor's office, the public health department, the National Guard, Mercy One, and all of our health systems, we are delighted to bring this new comprehensive approach to coordinating the care of patients that have COVID diagnosis and acute care patients that also need access to care. At Mercy One, we've benefited from a hospital transfer system for years. And to this day, we on average transfer about 14,000 individuals. We've used the framework and the technology and the structure of our transfer center with the support of the governor, the public health department, and the National Guard, and all health systems to expand this to take care of all hospital transfers within the state with one easy phone call. Any hospital who has to transfer a patient to another hospital for a bed can use the traditional process they've always used. In the event, however, that they want to make they find it difficult to place that patient, they can call the Iowa Hospital Transfer Line, make one call, and our team will take it from there. And we will work together with the Public Health Department and the National Guard. We will find the closest, most appropriate placement for that patient, and we effectively make that coordinate that transfer until it's complete. That way, our hospital teams can stay focused on their primary purpose, which is care for those individuals in need. I want to take this opportunity to thank two people on our team at Mercy One because they really came to the call. Diane Murphy and Shauna Gunn, two people who've run our transfer system for some time, partnered together with the governor's team, the public health department, and the National Guard and other health systems to make this possible. And we're so delighted for their commitment to do that. I can't tell you how pleased we are to bring this new tool to our toolkit to get through this pandemic. We're across the 50-yard line. I know we can see the end zone. We just don't know what the distance is, but we're in the right direction. And I think it's because of all of you coming together to make the state of Iowa really a showcase for how we can work to protect Iowans together. So, Governor, thank you very much for the honor to be here today, but thank you most importantly for your leadership and your partnership, and I'll move on. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. I just so appreciate your team's willingness to make this transfer service possible. And I want to thank all of Iowa's healthcare systems and hospitals, the Department of Public Health, and the National Guard, who will leverage this resource really to help benefit all of Iowans. Minutes matter when a person's health is in crisis, and this new transfer line is one more way that we can work together to get people the care that they need as quickly as possible. So I want to say thank you to you for leading this initiative. Bob, I know that you're on a tight schedule today, but I'm so glad that you were able to join us and talk about the new partnership that we have in place, and just am excited about the benefit that that's going to bring to healthcare personnel across the state of Iowa. So thank you very much. Thank you. So while we've learned a lot about COVID-19 since the pandemic began, one of the most encouraging facts is that the virus occurs less frequently in children than adults. Here in Iowa since March, children up to the age of 10 account for just 4% of all positive cases. 3% of cases occur among kids 11 to 14, and 6% are teens age 15 to 18. These percentages have remained consistent throughout the pandemic, even since school started this fall. According to the World Health Organization, children of all ages can be infected with COVID-19 and can spread the virus to others. However, studies show that children younger than 10 are less susceptible to COVID-19 and less likely to transmit the virus, while adolescents and teens are more likely to become infected. When positive cases do occur in schools, it's more likely that the virus is introduced by adult teachers and staff. Transmission within schools occurs most often between staff members, less often among staff and students, and it rarely occurs from student to student. These trends have been reported in countries across the globe, including the United States, and they're evident right here at home. Recently, Iowa's 327 public school districts and 119 accredited non-public schools were asked to voluntarily report certain COVID data to the Iowa Department of Education, including cases and mitigation efforts. And while only a portion of the schools are reporting, what we've learned is that the situation in our schools, it is consistent with these findings. Since the start of the school year, among schools reporting, less than 2% of Iowa's K-12 students have been infected with the virus. Anecdotally, most cases were due to an exposure outside of school, either because of community spread or because of a household member was positive. There continues to be substantial scientific evidence that COVID-19 has less effect on children's health than adults, and that schools are not a primary driver of the virus transmission and spread. In fact, the CDC has said that schools are the safest place for kids to be, and that it's school closures that can have a negative effect on their health, well-being, and development. Several more studies are now emerging that suggest extended school closures, seen as a solution for virus mitigation, are actually failing students. A new study by McKinsey and Company projects that students will continue to lag academically in schools if schools remain status quo in alternate learning models through the end of the school year. The study found that students learned only 67% of the math and 87% of the reading that grade-level peers would typically have learned by fall. students on average could lose 5 to 9 months of learning by the end of June 2021. Students of color could be 6 to 12 months behind, compared with 4 to 8 months for white students. But if schools reopen in January, the outlook is better. Then it predicts that learning loss would be less, 4 to 5 months for white students, 6 to 7 months for students of color. But make no mistake, that is still problematic. Iowa is not immune from this trend. Last week, Director Ann Lebo from the Department of Education shared that literacy screening scores decreased 21% among Iowa's first graders this fall. But we have time to turn this around. Last spring, when schools closed, it was a precautionary measure during a time when very little was known about COVID-19. But as time went by, I believe that getting our kids back to school would be one of the most important steps forward in our recovery. Thank you. Thankfully, Iowa's legislature felt the same way, and they drafted legislation that I signed into law requiring that at least 50% of learning must occur in person. But 50% of in-person learning shouldn't be a limiting factor. It should be a starting point. Now we can use the knowledge that we've gained and the overwhelming evidence that now exists to get our students back in the classroom full-time and make up for the learning that they've lost. As I mentioned last week, I've had the opportunity to speak with many parents from school districts across the state this fall. Some of them have children who return to school for full-time in-person learning, and while it isn't the same as in years past, it's working. And those families are grateful for the sense of normalcy and routine. But in other areas, parents are struggling to balance working from home while assisting their children with online learning, or are forced to leave the workforce and face an uncertain financial future. And families who count on their children's school for necessary support and services may not have the assistance that they desperately need. These are the parents who are now speaking up and voicing the need for more options that make better sense for the families and students served by Iowa schools. And one of those parents is Sarah Barthol, a working mom of a kindergartner and a third grader in Ankeny School District, who's now become an advocate for Iowa school students and families. I've asked Sarah to join me today and share her perspective, as well as what she's learned from a growing network of parents across the state. Sarah? Butchered your last name, I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Governor Reynolds, for inviting me to speak today. As you mentioned, my husband and I have two sons who are in third grade and kindergarten in the Ankeny Community School District. This year has certainly looked very different than we ever could have imagined. Our sons have spent most of the fall semester in a hybrid learning model, but over time, they've bounced between full-time, back to hybrid, then virtual, and now they're in hybrid again until holiday break. It's been a yo-yo of a year, which I know nobody wants. Kids are resilient, but I think we can also agree that children thrive in environments of routine and stability. Our family would love nothing more than for them to go to school every day in person to learn with their great teachers and be with their peers. When our boys are learning from home, we're not always able to give them the same time and attention that their teachers give them. My husband is an essential employee for a small business, and I work in IT delivery management. We both need to work to support our family, just like many Iowa families do. My husband goes into the office every day, and while I'm able to work remotely, my work doesn't stop or slow down just because my kids are at home with me. Our oldest son needs a little extra nudge to foster his reading development. While he is making great progress and strides, we knew that with the current school situation, he would need someone to give him a little extra time and attention to help keep him on track. Eventually, we opted to hire a tutor to come work with our boys every day one-on-one. Not every day, sorry. We're fortunate to have the ability to do this for them, but I know that's not possible for everyone. This is just one example of how we're making already existing disparities even more apparent. Elementary school age children are too young to be expected to do self-guided instruction on asynchronous days, not because they aren't capable technically, but because the development of their mind and capacity to learn requires instruction. They need teacher interventions and engagement every day. Education, especially in elementary, is done best by proximity, not a computer screen or whiteboard. These are instrumental years in setting and building their educational foundation for the rest of their academic careers. Even beyond education, schools play a critical role in our lives and in our communities. The socio-emotional, mental, and physical well-being of our kids is something they need, and they get it at school in a classroom. I know this to be true for my sons. Seeing the interactions they have with their peers and learning together is not something I can replicate at home for them. Isolating them and keeping them at home is not good for their long-term well-being. The boys have the best teachers we could ever ask for, and they have been so positive, graceful, and encouraging. They are working so hard and doing the very best they can with the circumstances we are in. Thank you to both of them. I believe in strong public schools. Our communities need them and thrive in them. I also believe in local control and autonomy to make decisions. But I also believe parents need to have a voice in the solutions and should help influence decisions that impact our students. I've been advocating for full-time school since the end of July when I learned the Ankeny's administration was recommending the hybrid model to start off the school year. When I first heard this, I was incredibly disappointed because I was never asked what I wanted for my sons, nor did I get to share parent input on developing return-to-learn plans or get the ability to choose what I felt would be best for them. So over the course of the last 5 months, I've tried everything to convince our administration and school board to let our kids go back full-time. I've created petitions, spoken at school board meetings, sent emails, made phone calls, and organized other parents to draw attention to the issues and impact this is having on our students, our families, and our community. My path has led me to meet many incredible people along the way, including parents with kids from a variety of backgrounds, teachers, representatives at local and state level, community members, and even the governor, which has led me to this opportunity today. This experience has also connected me to other parents from across the state that are in my same situation. Many of us are experiencing the same challenges and frustrations. Not only is it important for me to get my sons back to school in Ankeny, but all pre-K to 12 students across the state. I value education and how important it is for the future success of all children. We need to be thinking long-term and the impact this is going to have on our kids for years to come. As parents, we deserve a choice on what learning model we feel is best for our children. Parents have been able to select a full-time, 100% virtual option, which is great, and I'm glad we have it for those parents that want that experience. And parents like me want a choice to be able to send my kids to school full-time, 100% in person as well. It's a perfectly reasonable expectation that our school district would offer its families this option. Wanting full-time school doesn't make me or other parents insensitive to the challenges this is creating for everyone. Everybody has a different story. We know this is not easy, but we must find ways to overcome these challenges and provide our children with every opportunity to succeed. School districts of all sizes and enrollment across the state are making full-time in-person work. Whether you're at a small district or a large one like Ankeny, this should not be a determining factor of full-time school. Everyone needs to have a can-do mindset to make this happen. Generally speaking, 25 kids in the classroom is the same as 25 kids in a classroom, regardless of how big or small the school is, with safety protocols. We have to think differently than we are now and have before, and be open to new ideas because this is not sustainable for our students, our families, our communities, and our teachers. We can educate our kids in school safely, and there's more and more data and evidence that supports schools being the safest place for our kids pre-K through 12 to be. Our schools provide a controlled environment for safety and mitigation protocols, something you aren't guaranteed when kids aren't in the building regularly. I'm hopeful with all the recent new studies, CDC comments, reports, and stories that are showing support for in-person instruction. We're not gaining anything by having our kids out of school. It's time to pivot and move forward to get all of our kids back in the classroom. My hope and desire is that my sons and all students will get to return to school full-time in person at the start of second semester in January, if that's what their families want for them. In closing, I would like to thank Governor Reynolds again for giving me the opportunity to speak today and share my story. Parents, keep advocating for your kids. They need you now more than ever. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm sure you never imagined being in this position, but I commend you for all that you've done. You're helping people see that there are no easy solutions and that there are still many students and families whose needs remain unmet. But most importantly, thank you for stepping up for your community and reaching out across the state to other parents that are facing similar challenges. This is a true grassroots effort, people working together to influence change for the better, and just another reason why I truly am so proud to be an Iowan. So finally, Iowa's proclamation of disaster emergency, which expires tomorrow at midnight, will be extended through Wednesday, December 16th, with minimal changes. Organized sports and recreational events, including bowling leagues, may resume for youth and adults, but spectators are still limited to 2 per participant. The same 2 spectator rule that also applies to high school athletes will be extended to spectators for cheerleaders, band members, and others performing at high school sporting events. To ensure better consistency among restaurants, bars, and other venues that serve alcohol, including casinos, last call for in-person service will be at 10 p.m. Finally, with hospitalization rates decreasing, we're easing restrictions on elective procedures for our hospitals from a 50% reduction to a 25% reduction. We will continue to monitor virus activity over the next several days, and we'll assess whether additional changes may be possible a week from now. And with that, I'll take your questions.
Governor, are you considering changing your directive to schools?
So I'm bound by the statute right now. So we've had lengthy discussions about that. Are you talking about the waiver requirements?
Well, based on what your guest speaker said.
Yeah, well, that's something that'll have to be taken up by the legislature next session. So right now, based on the statute that we're operating under, it says that they have to at least be in person 50% of the time. And so And then I have to say that in the health declaration. I have to acknowledge that to allow them to go online for the other 50%, which we've done. So
legislators.
I think the kids, I think parents need to have the option to be in school. I think we need to do everything we can right now to get our kids back in the classroom. And I believe that the data supports that. I believe eventually we're going to potentially be doing more harm than we are by keeping them out of school. And I think the data every day continues to support that decision for a whole host of reasons. And we've seen great success. And I think, you know, I lose sight sometimes about the number of schools that are actually doing that, Kay. So I need to commend probably 85% of our school districts across the state, and I can get you a more specific number, or we can have Ann reach out. But by far, the majority of schools have the kids back in the classroom 5 days a week with layered mitigation efforts, and they're doing everything they can to make sure that those kids are there in a safe and responsible way. And I believe that's what we need to do as Iowans. I believe we can do it. Our parents are asking for it. I do agree that it was important that we have an option for parents to go 100% online, because some kids do have underlying conditions. And again, until we better understand completely all there is to COVID, and some parents have underlying conditions, so they have the opportunity to make that decision. And I think parents need the opportunity to also have the decision to go 100% in the classroom.
Governor, if you're going to push for that, the teachers and staff right now are in that second tier under the vaccination plan. Do you have a way of ensuring them that they'll be in that batch? So if schools are required to come back full time, that those workers can be protected?
Yeah, so if you remember, Director Garcia last week talked about the response team, that the IDEC team that they're putting together to really start to review what that second phase looks like. They are meeting this week tomorrow for the first time. And we've had a lot of correspondence about different workforce that feel that they're essential workers. And so that would be, so we're collecting all of those, and then the group will start to work through some of those decision points. Kelly, do you have anything to add to that? Okay.
Governor, in today's updates, there are 102 additional deaths. If you look at the White House Coronavirus Task Force, we as a state are better than average when it comes to testing, but we remain one of the worst when it comes to deaths per 100,000 people. Well, why is that?
And so that's over the last 7 days. I think when you look overall, we're about in the middle where we have consistently been. I'll make sure that I get you the accurate place of where we're at. And with the way that we've changed the methodology in which we're reporting deaths, there is some lag time. So, Dave, we are going to see additional, probably higher numbers than normal of deaths come in. But we have to remember that because of the lag time through the national lab that we're going through, the National Center for Health Statistics, that will probably go back 2 to 3 weeks. And so they will still be accounted for what the date is on the death certificate. If you go to the website, you'll see how those are accounted for by the actual day of the death.
Governor, how many pharmacists and technicians does Walgreens and CVS have? And is it enough staffing to vaccinate all of our long-term care facilities quickly?
Well, I'm going to turn that over to Kelly, but the thing that I do know, it was going to require just an incredible amount of stress on an already stressed workforce in the state of Iowa. So we are grateful that they have not only the people to allocate and operationalize the distribution, but to also give the vaccines. I don't know if we have numbers, but
I don't have specific numbers on the number of employees that they have, but what I can tell you, and there is a third pharmacy as well, Community Pharmacy, which is out of Nebraska and is covering a small portion of the long-term care facilities located in our state, but we have been meeting with them for the past several days, and they have absolutely assured us that they have enough staff to make a significant impact in these first several weeks.
Governor, why do you extend the proclamation only another week? Wouldn't that create more uncertainty?
No, I've said, honestly, if you think about it, go back and look at the press conferences. We look at it on a daily basis. We review it on a daily basis. We review it on a weekly basis. And if we continue to see the trends decrease like we're seeing, which I thank you, Iowans, for helping us accomplish that and seeing the pressures, you know, start to relieve. We still have a long ways to go on our hospitals, but they are seeing some relief. I've said all along, we'll dial up and we'll dial back as appropriate. And so that's the same thing that we've done from the beginning of the pandemic.
Governor, the issue of the two doses for a vaccine,
yep,
it would seem that perhaps that could pose some logistical challenges in ensuring Iowans get that second dose that's needed. Perhaps this is a question for Kelly, Director Garcia, but what is the state's plan to ensure that Iowans are following up and getting that vaccine for the second dose?
I'll let Kelly, because she'll have more of the details, but they are tracking all of that. So there's a system in place to account for that.
That's a great question. It is really important that all Iowans come back in to get that same dose that they received and in the right interval for this vaccine to work. And so we've got a couple of different techniques that we'll be deploying to ensure that that happens. The first, as the governor mentioned, is we have extensive tracking mechanisms, both at pharmacy locations and other provider locations, as well as the state system. The second is a card. It's a simple item, but a reminder of exactly what that date is and which vaccine you received, and then the interval to take that appointment again. We're also working on other technology supports that might give a more proactive reminder. And so that is very much in the works. Certainly for the National Pharmacy Chain Partnership Program, that is absolutely something that they are working on to make sure. And then that's more scheduled. So we have assurances there that that will happen.
But the state's IT system has had its challenges. Is the department's IT infrastructure equipped to notify people beyond, if you mentioned some technological reminders or working that out, I mean, is the state prepared to be able to actually handle that?
So our system doesn't have that kind of proactive notification to an individual. We've been thinking about how we might be able to layer on some of that support if necessary, but working really with those local providers. That's the space where it should come from. And that's the space, I'm sorry, Governor. That's the space where we would want to see, because that hook back into your provider remains incredibly important.
And following up on Following up on the Pfizer vaccine specifically, Director Garcia, the last press conference, you mentioned the distribution of that vaccine, that the first set of 172,000 that we're getting of both the Moderna, Pfizer will be first doses. Will the news that the Pfizer vaccine may be delayed change that plan at all?
Yeah. No, go ahead. I figured that you would ask the question. We do not have any information from our federal partners that there's a delay in supply. And in fact, they can keep reminding us to push out that initial dose, and they have reserved the second dose. So we continue to work with that information. We're obviously monitoring national news, just as you all are. But we really do need to work directly with our federal partners, and we have assurances from them that we are okay to proceed.
Okay. I would just encourage parents out there to talk to your educators, talk to your school boards, and let's get our kids back in school. Thank you.